Good afternoon and welcome to the March meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Hedges Hall and Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience reaching us through the good offices of the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, MPBN. I'm Tom DeMarco, filling in for Mac DeFord, who is president of the forum. The forum was founded in 1983, so it's now in its 34th year of bringing you on a monthly basis informed commentator on all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. diplomatic policies. Details about our past and upcoming audios, plus upcoming programs, plus audios, available at our website, midcoastforum.org. This is meeting number 397 of the forum. The topic today is Libya. You may remember Libya was a key element of our young republic's almost first foreign policy crisis. Remember the Barbary pirates, Jefferson's first term, the Barbary War of 1801, the Marines, the shores of Tripoli, and all that. Between the shores of Tripoli, we have kind of a blank in most Americans' understanding of Libya, between the shores of Tripoli all the way up to the Congress's Benghazi Commission. So we thought it'd be nice to have someone to fill us in on some of those blanks. And we were lucky enough to find Professor Ali Ameda, who is at the University of New England, founding chair of the Department of Political Sciences there. He is a Libyan, born in Wadan, Libya, educated at in Cairo, in Libya, first of all, and then in Cairo, and then finally in the United States. He is a Libya scholar. Now, that sounds like, what do you need to be a Libya scholar? Well, you need to be a Libyan. No, it's much more complicated than that, because Libya was colonized so many times by the Romans, by the Ottomans, by the Italians, effectively by the British and French during the war. So in order to be a Libyan scholar, you have to master not just Arabic, but Arabic and English and French and Italian, most important of all, Italian. So Dr. Ameda does that for us. He's the author of The Making of Modern Libya, State Formation, Colonization, and Resistance, a book which was published by the State University of New York Press. We're delighted to have you, Ali Ameda.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Tom, and thank you for inviting me to come to this beautiful part of the state of Maine, maybe the prettiest city in the state. In this gorgeous day, it's wonderful to be here. I'll give you some way of thinking about what we don't know about Libya, and then try to present to you a narrative of why Libya had this really optimistic image in 2011, and then after that, it's unraveled and declined into a very, very unfortunate civil war today. And what's the future really is going to be for that country and its people? If I will start with the topic, what are the main things that we don't know about Libya and its people? And let's talk about the modern times, because we don't want to go into the very rich, deep history, including last night we talked about the most gorgeous, maybe complete Roman city, Leptis Magnus. It's in Libya, and it's beautiful beaches, and it's a very, very, it's a very much a big country that's still unexplored. Maybe the last version, a part of the Mediterranean, and the third largest city in Africa. Perhaps it's bigger than even Alaska. So we have a visual image of that. The Libyan people in the 20th century, they fought two important goals. The first one, the struggle for self-determination. The second one is for social and economic modernization and opportunities. So I could say the national question and also the social question. Libya wasn't just another African, Middle Eastern, or Latin American country that went through colonization and domination by European powers or Asian powers like Japan or so. Libya went through colonization in the 20th century by uncommon colonizing power. Italy, the French, and the English, of course, dominated Africa and the Near East, and the Spanish colonialism also to a point, and the Portuguese. Libya was invaded in 1911, and the Italian state controlled Libya in 1931. After 20 years of resistance, And then in 1943, the Allies took over North Africa, and Libya was administered by the British in the eastern and the western regions, and the Libyan south was controlled by the French. In 1951, Libya became independent. In 1969, the Federal Democratic Monarchy was toppled by young officers in the Libyan army, and that group of young officers was led by a fiery nationalist officers became known in the international arena as Colonel Gaddafi or Muammar Gaddafi. That regime continued until 2011, when a major uprising in the city of Benghazi managed to protest against the regime, and things got out of hand at the end with the support of NATO and our own government in the United States. The regime was defeated, and a new government emerged, transitional government, did well at the beginning and then stalled at the end. That's a kind of a broad outline for us. Some of you probably very well know that history, maybe others won't. So this is just a broad outline for the Libyan modern history. What's not very well known is the fact that Libya, especially under the fascists, suffered one of the most brutal and violent colonization in the whole continent of Africa, with the exceptions of the Congo. If you remember the Heart of Darkness, that gives you an idea, some of you. And Southwest Africa, which is called Namibia. And the bloody, of course, war in Algeria. Some of you will probably remember the Algerian question was as big as the Vietnam War before the Vietnam War. Suffice to say that the colonization was brutal if we remember two things. That between 1911 and 1950, Libyan population declined so drastically. According to Ottoman census in 1910, Libya had 1 million to 1.5 million population. By 1950, Libya had 1 million. So we think, figuratively, directly and indirectly, 500,000 perished during the first half of the 20th century, including 60,000 who died in concentration camps before the Holocaust. That very, very violent and genocidal history is not very well known. I wrote my dissertation on the anti-colonial resistance, and I spent 15 years collecting material on the survivors by interviewing the survivors of the internment, who after 1 year agreed to talk to me. For the last 15 years, I collected between 250 to 300 interviews. I'm writing a book, will be published next year by Stanford University Press. So that brutal history is not very well known, and I think that shaped the national question. Libyan people are very fearful of Europe, are very, very, have a bitter experience about what happened to them and their grandparents and their parents, but also some disappointed that their stories are not very well known. So people talk about only about Gaddafi, terrorism, oil, and nothing really about Libyan people themselves, civil society itself, not much of that. And even our media and our scholarship has been really in the dark as far as having in-depth understanding, not only the leaders and the government, but also the experience of the society itself. Another interesting thing that's not very well known about Libya is Libya actually in 1918 had, especially in the western part of the country, founded the first republic in the Arab world and the Muslim world. And that republic wanted to have four people leadership. They want to exercise self-determination and even sent a request for support from the United States, from England, from France, from other countries. And unfortunately, nobody really replied to them because at that time, Italy was very, very strong and silenced them. And 3 years after Mussolini and the fascists took over the government of Italy, they had an iron fist policy and they crushed all the agreement, including the republic. And they crushed the resistance in 1931 with the hanging of an elderly charismatic leader by the name of Omar al-Mukhtar. Some of you may have seen our Hollywood movie called Lion of the Desert. Anthony Quinn played his role. So with his charismatic character being Irish, Mexican, and so he had a really is very well suited for playing all of those very interesting characters in many movies. And he played the role of Omar Mukhtar, who was 73 years old, and finally he was captured and hanged, and he became really the father of modern Libya. So all Libyans, when they talk about the father of the country, that elderly, charismatic, uncorruptible man, Omar Mukhtar, became the symbol of the country. So to give you an idea about symbols, the monarchy in 1951 made a shrine for him. Gaddafi said that we are the heirs of Omar Mukhtar, and even had the 10 dinar currency, his picture there. When the young men and women challenged the Gaddafi regime, they appealed and they almost took that image, that symbol from the Gaddafi's regime, and they said, we are the true heirs, and they declared him as their own one. In other words, that the national symbols are still matter in Libyan culture. And they invited me to visit Benghazi and Tripoli, and so I took pictures, and his picture was everywhere. And it was fascinating to me because it's, you know, emphasized that the anti-colonial, you know, nationalist feeling is still resonates among ordinary Libyans till today. So that's the national question. The social question, which is also very important in, for us to understand, is there was this drive for education opportunities, for healthcare, for building infrastructure. And Libya was a very poor colony. And thank God, you know, Mussolini did not really discover that there was oil underneath. I think he's spinning in his grave now. Knowing that oil was there. In 1959, oil was discovered, and production of oil began in the early 60s, and Libya changed from one of the poorest countries in the world to one of the richest countries. And my good luck, I was born after independence. My both parents had limited opportunities. My father studied in Italian school and Quranic schools, and then finished college after that, became a teacher. My mother was born in exile in a country called Chad. There were no schools, there were no clinics, and she was a very bright woman, but she had no education. Sister always say, you know, imagine that your mother went to college, we're all gonna be in trouble. I mean, we are in trouble with her without going to college. Imagine that she did that, she went to college. So just to give you an idea about how those conditions impacted society in general. Something very interesting happened in Libya. Since 1951, education began to surge. The monarchy established schools, and illiteracy rate began to decline. Libya had horrible illiteracy rate, one of the highest in the 90s. That education continue, the social question continue, where society emphasized, you know, opportunities for men and women. And by 2011, that's very interesting. Now, Gaddafi, Libyans will tell me, Ali, professor, he ruined education. Libyan education used to be good. But each generation thinks that the education of their time was better than today. I think it's that universal in many ways. But remarkable, because Libya has now the highest literacy rate in Africa, including for females, better than even Tunisia, which is highlighted as the golden standard in our Western coverage. And also, the Libyan society was very rural in 1950. Now, 80% of the Libyan population lives in cities. Actually, in five cities, 80% of the Libyan population lives in cities. Social question is society insistence in really pushing modernization and education opportunities. Now, this is where the society succeeded. Libyans are very good in resisting colonialism and really resisting the state, and very tenacious about who they are. Very provincial, other Arabs, they think they are not as cosmopolitan, they are not as sophisticated, but in many ways they are really, they cling to their own autonomous communities and their own organizations. But unfortunately, there is a legacy, which is very, very, I think, still a flaw in Libyan historical national experience, that national institutions are weak. And Gaddafi and his fellow young officers exploited the monarchy alliance with United Kingdom and also with the United States, the military bases, all of that things to say that the monarchy was really a client state. It was a modernizing democratic state more than most of the Gulf states and the other states. It was limited in a certain way, but the problem with the monarchy that it established educational and social modernization program, but limited political participation. And the young men and women who were educated in their school, in the army, had higher expectation after that, and they were calling for more. The army toppled the regime in 1969. Gaddafi's regime succeeded the first 10 years, and then it became a dictatorship, using the oil money to control the population and became a rentier state. The idea of anti-colonialism, the suffering of the Libyan people was abused and used for all kind of purposes. But then the forces that, you know, the younger people, we're talking about almost the average age of Libyan, 24 years old. So we're talking about a very young population. And unfortunately, 30% was unemployed. So you have an educated population with high expectations, but so saturated with the cult of hero, the cult of personality, and the hazardous of staying in power way too long. That historical and national background is important in understanding what happened in 2011. And go to post-2011. And I'll make the following argument. The 2011 uprising was a genuine popular revolt against a dictatorship that was decaying and really out of touch with the realities of Libyan society and the world around it. Had this dictatorship opened itself for reform that started in the 1990s through his son, Saif al-Islam, probably Libyan people would have waited a little bit. But because Gaddafi and the elite refused to have a genuine reform and recognizing the problems, social, economic, and cultural problems that exist in society and the lack of freedom and rule of law, convinced many members of the layers of Libyan society to say, this regime is not reformable. And that's a very, very common thing. You try to reform something. If it works, okay. If it doesn't work, you say maybe the inevitable is to change it. Now, the problem in Libya is the following. The coalition that challenged the regime and toppled the regime with the help of NATO and outside support did not really think the day after what we should be replaced the regime with. And they thought that we'll figure that out later on. And that was a big mistake. Libya now has three governments, one in Tobruk, two in Tripoli, de facto civil war, where some cities are emerged as very victorious because of the militarization of the uprising and the arms that were really wide everywhere in Libya, in addition to the outside support. So what you have the Tobruk parliament, you have government of national accord established in 2015. You have also the old General People Congress government called the Salvation National Salvation Government. And you have General Haftar, Khalifa Haftar in eastern Libya, facing very, very hard Salafi and jihadist groups in Derna, in Benghazi, and also Daesh in Sirte. And you have Islamist and non-Islamist coalition in western Libya dominated by the city of Busrata. And in the south, you have really no group dominated except a minority group coming from northern Chad and some are Libyan called the Tibu, who were armed by the Gaddafi regime, the new Transitional National Council in 2011. So what you have, I describe it sometimes as a body with three heads. Imagine that three heads are talking to each other. A society that's literate, society that urbanized, society that has tremendous wealth, society that has a good opportunity to be really rebuilt. At the same time, leadership that has a zero-sum mentality, game mentality, where us vis-a-vis the others, they're trying to defeat each other. And as a result, people are suffering everywhere. Security, no police, no national army. And add to that a very important factor. Not only the failure of the leadership, regional and international community contributed to the Libyan crisis. It's not just a Libyan crisis. And here we have to understand, give you a geography or a roadmap to what's going on in there. Turkey, Qatar are supporting the Islamists. Egypt supporting General Haftar. Saudi Arabia supporting Salafi movement. United Arab Emirates supporting General Haftar. the European community are jockeying and trying to support this city or so. The city of Misrata was armed by Turkey, Italy, UK, and Qatar. And our Obama, in my opinion, really, with even the president admitted, this is the worst mistake of his presidency. Gaddafi's regime was toppled not only because of the uprising, but also because of the NATO intervention. But there was no plan to rebuild the peace, rebuild the state. The Obama administration left that role to its regional allies, the Turkish government, the Qatari government, and the European community, which failed miserably to resolve that. And they continue to find allies and surrogate client forces inside Libya. So combination of a very, very myopic leadership inside Libya, strengthened and supported by regional and international policies, and the disastrous Obama administration's no intervention after Iraq. He used even a very colorful expression, if you read the interview in the Atlantic. But he admitted that Libya was really, we failed Libya. So that's why we have now, instead of a country that could have worked well with its oil, with its educated population, which a good size, for the rest, it became now a nightmarish engulfed by civil war. My argument is that Libya is not a case of failed state. Libya is a case of failed transition. The only successful one was at the beginning, the National Transitional Council turned power to the General People's Congress. And Libyan people voted 3 times, men and women, in internationally observed elections. But the militias and the armed groups are the ones who are ruling the country. And they undermined that decision. So I think what Libya needs is stop the regional and international apathy or manipulation of the Libyan democratic process and transition. Rain on the allies, the Qataris, the Turks, the other groups who are trying to feed into this crisis and fragment Libya for their own really expediency and local narrow interests. And the Libyan leadership that led the transition, we have to admit, it was miserable. It failed so much to live to the expectation of really the people who have high hopes in this. So what Libya needs is a new transition. And I said that what we Libyan need to do, and that was in Arabic in Libyan TV, one of the channels, there are zillions of them now, and they asked me what to do. I said, you know, the first thing you need to admit, exercise the right for assessment and self-criticism of what went wrong. Admitting the mistakes will lead you to understand why there was a dead end now. And the second thing is there is no escape of having a transitional period where the two major military powers, General Haftar in the east and the Misrata brigades in the west, have to compromise. And by pressure on them, by the UN, by the United States, maybe the Trump administration will understand this and try to play a positive and productive role in that. I think if that will happen, then maybe Libya will have a second transition and maybe could recover and correct the mistakes of the earlier transition. But also there is another scenario. History is not one-way street, as we know. History, many possibilities, because history doesn't stop. Unless that transition targeting the main issues, collecting arms, building a new army, empowering the institutions, all of these things are essential for that. Unless that happens, I think Libya will have a long, long history, and maybe it will be another Somalia in the Mediterranean, as the cliche says, which is very sad for its people who are very, very longed for democratic, stable, ordinary system that allows them to flourish and continue to take care of themselves and their children. And I think in that sense, there are many possibilities for the Libyan people. What we could do for them is to get busy to educate ourselves about their concerns and go beyond the cliches and the simplistic ideas about oil and terrorism and so, because Daesh and Al-Qaeda are alien to Libyan society. Daesh and Al-Qaeda are actually exported from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia, and other places. Libyan Islam is a Sunni Maliki Islam and Ibadi Islam that's very moderate and very much a civic religion like our own civic religion. So there's no really difference in that sense. Religion will continue to play a role, but these a new vision of Islam, they're actually recent constructions, and they are not really indigenous, nor they have social base in Libya. But when we have a civil war, when you have an open frontiers, organization like Al-Qaeda will find a space. So the future is mixed bag. I wouldn't say it's bleak completely, nor I would say it's very optimistic. It could be either way. And I hope that the lessons of the last 4 years will be learned and maybe a new transition will start in Libya. The last point I want to share with you, I was part of this uprising from distance, from my American side. As a Libyan-American scholar, I always try to keep an eye and keep in touch with my friends and colleagues there. My books, they banned them. Two of them were banned when they translated into Arabic. But by the 1990s, the regime began to loosen up a little bit, and they allowed me to visit and give talks in Libya. When the uprising began, some of my friends, including the one who led the government, Mahmoud Jibril, who was a classmate of mine in Cairo, asked me, "Professor, would you like to join us?" And I said, "I think there's a lot to be done in America. We don't know much about Libya and the Arab Spring, especially Libya, and I could be useful here." And I tried for the last 5 years to engage in all kind of talks and presentations to engage our public opinion about Libya and get the public to go beyond the cliches and try to educate ourselves about what's going on so we'll sympathize with the Libyan people and their struggle for a democratic, stable republic. Let's hope that's the case.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Ali. It's a surprising thing to say, but you have given us a reasonably optimistic picture. We get very few of these at the Midcoast Forum. A failed, not a failed state, but a failed transition. That's already more optimistic than we usually hear. Let's go back over the body with three heads.
Yes.
You said there were elections where the Libyan people stated their preference. Did they state a preference for one of those three heads?
Okay, let's take this question first and then we'll go over the other ones. There were two major elections in addition to the constitutional commission to write the new constitution. The SMS did not really win big, which doesn't surprise me. I know some of you expected that to be everywhere. In Libya, it wasn't the case. Actually, Libyans find that very offensive, that Islamist political party. They say, "We all are Muslims. Who want to tell us about our Islam?" The Muslim Brothers and the other political parties associated with political Islam did not do well in the 2012 and 2014 elections for the parliament. The Islamist groups and the Masrata brigades did not allied with it. They took over the capital and they established a new government, and they refused that, and so the parliament could not convene in Tripoli, and they found an eastern city, Tobruk, as an alternative, because Benghazi also was a war zone in that. So the new government, so you have the old government that was established in 2012, called the National Salvation Government. The new government that established after the second election, 2014, that went to Tobruk, headed by a man by the name of Abdullah Tini. And the third one was established after the Skhirat agreement to bring the two together in Morocco by the UN, and it's now headed by a man called Faiz al-Sarraj.
Well, now, in your opinion, which of these has more legitimacy than the others?
Well, the the Eastern one,
the Tobruk one,
based on the parliament, but also the Skhirat agreement brought the parliament representative and the General Congress. So it's supposed to, Sarraj is supposed to be the legitimate one, but the parliament has not really voted, give it a vote of confidence yet. So the most plausible way is the parliament will convene and give the new government by Mr. Sarraj a vote of confidence. That didn't happen. As a result, we have a contending government still in the process. And that, why it was delayed? Because Libyan society is still militarized and people are fighting in some cities as well, in some of the regions there. So the Sarraj government ideally should be the one that should lead the transition. But since it hasn't received that vote of confidence, you know, there is a contentious situation right now.
Okay, good. So it's not a slam dunk that one has all the legitimacy and the other is not.
No. It got a little bit complex, and now because there is a fighting in some section of the country, the politicians are really also dependent on the armed groups and the militias.
Okay, well, we have some questions about the oil revenues.
Yes. You
said Libya got rich, but were the riches reasonably distributed, or did they leave the country?
That's a good question. Well, oil was discovered, but who managed and exported oil? Of course, multinational corporations, and the Libyan government got a revenue. Up until the early 70s, Gaddafi nationalized many of these oil companies and negotiated different prices for oil. So it was the government that controlled it, and the international oil companies, including some American companies, that also made good revenues. And earlier days, actually, the taxes were very, very, system in the United States was very friendly to these companies, so they didn't have to pay a lot of taxes as well. The Libyan society gained under the two regimes from these new revenues in terms of education, in terms of schools, medical care, building roads and cities and airports and so. And under the monarchy and the Gaddafi regime, I would claim this modernization program continued. Of course, there are people who benefit more than others who are part of the monarchy elite and also the Gaddafi inner circles. But in general, I think Libyan society benefits from it. However, to what extent under Gaddafi the Libyan society should be more prosperous or not, the answer is they really wasted a lot of revenues on very adventurous projects in Africa and other parts of the globe, or the glory of his revolution. And for that matter, it could have been better.
If Libya succeeds in establishing self-determination, it's a hard question, but how will it fit into the world? More Western-looking, like a European country, or will it ally itself with Asian, Middle Eastern, Islamic State? How do you see it fitting into the whole puzzle?
I think Libya has been a member of the UN since 1951 and has been a modernizing a new country, came a long way socially and culturally, but not politically, because it suffered from the military dictatorship after 1969. And I think Libya is both an Arab, it's a Muslim, it's an African, and yes, westernized country too. I think the idea that either they have to be either West or East, not very accurate. When I look at Libyan society, it has all of those aspects. If you look at their dress, Libyan cuisine, Libyan architecture, Libyan education, it's a mixture. A lot of people don't know that most of the Libyan professional class, engineers, academics, journalists, most of them since the 1950s were educated in American universities. I always refer Libyan attitude toward America as the Polish attitude toward America, which is very romantic, very positive, and because of a lot of people either were educated in America or their children grow up in here, it has that aspect. But it has its own Arab, Libyan, Mediterranean aspect too. So I think it fits very nicely, but it has to find its own voice and we have to be patient to allow them to be themselves. And I think that's going to take a lot of thinking, you know, not only telling them where we could help them, but also listening to what they have to say about their own problems and their own society.
We have a number of questions about what a U.S. policy ought to be, assuming we had a rational policy. What would that rational policy be toward Libya?
I think we will be very, very, you know, popular people if we have a magical solution for that. Foreign policies are all contested. American foreign policy toward Libya has always centered around two aspects during the Cold War: strategic location and oil. Especially after Nasser revolution, the military revolution in Egypt in 1952, Libya became alternative country for military bases, for alliances, for all kind of reasons. Even Peace Corps. I run once in a while to people who email me or talk to me that they were in Libya at that time. I think for that matter, these are important historically. I would like to add society to society interests is maybe our soft power, our interest in building bridges with Libya and when it comes to education, building universities, seeing and visiting the treasures of Libya, allowing Libyan children, young men and women to come and see Libya, to see America. I think that dimension, that kind of soft power, I would like to add it to the strategic power. I think the Libyan leaders have to really look hard at the mistakes and the errors of their foreign policy. But also, we in America, we need to think about what we learned from the last 60, 50 years. And I think there's a lot to be done because it's a small country, but it's a very important country. It's the largest country, one of the largest countries in Africa. It has a tremendous impact on the region in terms of migration, in terms of employment of thousands of Tunisian and Egyptians there and Africans. And also, it has one of the finest oil. And I know oil probably running away now as a precious commodity. They had they call it sweet oil, the Libyan oil, because it's a fine quality and also close to refiners in Europe, and for a long time was used for specific purposes. So I think there are a lot of mutual interests between the Libyan people and the American people.
Now, one of the things you suggest is that interaction between Libyans, allowing Libyans to come here and learn about America, can be constructive. How do the travel bans and the looming travel bans affect that?
That's very unfortunate, Tom, because the ban is really against countries, including Libya, where there are many. To this day, I don't know if any terrorists radicalized or misguided young man or woman from Libya who committed any act of terrorism here. And from a personal perspective, I always wanted to go and visit as Libyan American. And now this is really going to cause tremendous hardship to both Americans who want to go visit and especially Libyans.
Well, yourself, for instance, can you go and come back?
I can't. I can't go to Libya now because it's very dangerous, and also I was very critical of some stuff there, especially in Western Libya.
No, could you come back is the question, though.
Well, I hope so, but yeah. I'll tell you, I was invited to give a talk in Cairo in 2 weeks, and my wife is very nervous because she said, you know, are you sure you want to go? I said, you know, I'm an American citizen. What are they going to do? They're going to block me, and I'm too old now to be suspicious. So I decided to go because if the worst could happen is they ask me questions and I'll answer them as I think I'll be comfortable, because for a long time before I became a citizen, I used to travel and the Libyan government will sometimes delay me quite a bit. We need to rethink this because they're going to cause more. I mean, there's nothing wrong with vetting people. There's nothing wrong to be alert about terrorism. There's nothing wrong of being extra careful and judicious about these things. But also to have a blank thing to say, no, anybody from these countries, though, I think we need to reconsider this. And I hope the Trump administration will be persuaded to rethink this.
But you are going to Egypt.
Yes, I am.
You are. And you plan to talk to them rationally on the way back in. And
yeah.
The sound you hear, Ali, is 120 people crossing their fingers in the room. Yeah. Libya was worrisome in the past because it had a flirtation with chemical weapons, maybe even a nuclear program at various times. Is that an ongoing worry? I mean, is there something about Libya that might make it want to arm itself again?
I don't think now Libya under the Gaddafi's government was a very nationalist, very populist at the beginning and became national, a dictatorship at the end.
Oh, that's upsetting.
Yes. So in that, but also let's put things in a historical perspective. Many, the drive for modernization was big. And the idea of really having, protecting your national interests was as big even for a small country like Libya. So there it was presented to the Libyan people as something to protect the national sovereignty of Libya. I don't think we should worry about it now because the program was dismantled. And that was a successful attempt to dismantle a nuclear program. What happened after that, unfortunately, did not materialize where you reform the process and open Libya to the international community. And we know the result of this. But as far as nuclear weapons, and that's really now passé. Libyan people are struggling for stability, national army, and dismantling the armed groups.
As you look at the various power groups within Libya that are contending, how much of them is homegrown? How much is imported?
Well, most of them are homegrown. This is really a fascinating case, where sad case, because arms were everywhere. And the Libyan regime bought arms from everywhere. And what you have also, all the prisoners let go in 2011, hard criminals as well. Add to that, the most pivotal moment was the mistake. The Libyan army was not really kept, and the Libyan police force was also not really kept. And therefore, the mistakes of Iraq were repeated. I warned so much against it, but unfortunately, that mistake led to severe consequences as far as instability and violence. In that vacuum, armed groups in towns and cities, especially the one that had more arms like Misrata and Zintan and cities that became really city-state of their own, like Derna in the eastern region, they became cities, they had their own kind of fiefdom or their own governance. And the problem is when you have that problem where guns everywhere and there is no police, there is no national army, that's a recipe for disaster. And many of these young men, they will not give up there because they have this prestige, they could impose sanctions, they think they are really big deal, and therefore they oppose any change of the status quo. So therefore, the armed groups became a reality, and they are the ruling power in Libya now. The politicians are dependent on those armed groups. And unless the national army, after a political compromise, being rebuilt and recalled, I don't think there will be any stability in Libya.
So you keep referring to the vacuum that has fostered the current situation. Would a peacekeeping force be a reasonable approach to that, and would it be accepted, do you think, an international peacekeeping force?
I personally don't think it's a good idea. I think Libyans need to really, especially the leading groups, including the armed groups, they need to make a compromise for the sake of the country and for the sake of everybody, that everybody will be a winner. There will be nobody dominating this, and everybody will be respected, nobody will be executed. I think that's really the right opinion. Some other Libyans and other experts, they think of the same idea, Tom. I don't think that's really, knowing Libyan sensitivity and Libyan, also the outside intervention that really was a negative role in the Libyan crisis now, I think that might be not, in my opinion, the right thing to do. But pressuring the major actors and players to come together and say, listen, a national army is important for everybody. Those armed men and women should be maybe incorporated individually in the new armed forces, or giving scholarship, or giving education, or giving jobs somewhere. And also, there has to be a plan for institution building that include army and police above all. If you don't have that, there will be really chaos everywhere.
You've barely mentioned Tunisia, yeah. A neighbor state where the Arab Spring began. Tunisia is perhaps the only country that's benefited from the Arab Spring. Is it a model for what should happen in Libya, or is it entirely Tunisian?
Tunisia is a very interesting case. I think in one aspect, Tunisia did something what I advocated for a long time, which I think is very, very positive. The opposition groups and the major actors in Tunisia met and agreed on a roadmap. And they agreed there will be election, they will be respecting the decision, there will be compromises and not try to contest the election that happens. So they did that in the early struggle against the Ben Ali dictatorship. And I think for that, we saw even the Islamists accepted the Troika and also the compromise and respected the election results in Tunisia. I think in that sense, Tunisia is very, very, should be praised for that, especially the elite in managing this. But also, let's not get carried away. Tunisia for a long time was seen as a model for modernization and westernization, and so that's really a myth, because beneath that, there was a very bloody dictatorship. Not only this, in Tunisia, you have tremendous disparity between rich coastal and the city of Tunis and impoverished and marginalized southern Tunisia and northwestern Tunisia. And that social and regional disparities and contradiction completely overlooked. And unless you resolve that, you're going to deal with something really odd. I'll give you an example. Thousands of young Tunisians, they're supposed to be westernized, modern, cosmopolitan, small country, exports the most radical jihadists and Salafists, including Libya and Iraq and Afghanistan. There must be something wrong. If this is so modernizing and so cosmopolitan and successful, why young people are alienated to become radicalized and accept a very, very nihilist and very, very kind of violent ideology? So that's what I'm talking about. Tunisia should be recognized for its elite, for compromising and getting together, but that what's really going to haunt Tunisian society is the fact that they have, unless they address the social poverty, disparities, unemployment in the region that completely dominated for almost 60 years or 70 years. All of those flowery ideas about cosmopolitanism and modernization and progress and so would be really superficial.
A simplistic view of the history of Iraq is that we're trying to push together a country that really would like to divide itself in three. Is it possible that that's what's in store for Libya? Does it want to be separated into the smaller groups around these three heads?
We have to pause here and say no, because in my opinion, we have to look at critically at what happened in Iraq. It's true in America, we tend to say, oh God, I mean, all of those exaggerated weapons of mass destruction and disasters, rush to war and all of that. Now, in America, we debated it a little bit. And I think it was a healthy debate. But then we stopped and we assumed that, okay, Iraq, they should really fix their own country and we move on. No, there are other lessons we need to learn. That the most, you know, ideological scholars and experts misguided us in Iraq. They looked at Iraq through the lenses of, are you a sectarian or regional? Iraqi society existed since 1920, folks. Yes, it's diverse and complex, but it succeeded. There is something called Iraqi society, very modernizing, very, very interesting state that existed from 1920 until 2003. And we have to look at that, at least to look at Iraq. Because our expert decided, we were going to find either, are you a Shi'i or are you a Sunni? Are you a Kurd or an Arab? It's true, but also you overlook, there's also an old Iraqi sentiment. And not everybody will identify through sectarian or religious identity. And I think that was the flaw in our experts and our pundits who saw through only through these lenses, and therefore, we want to see only what we want to see. And I think that was a big problem. Learning from the mistakes in Iraq, destroying the institution, including the army, excluding people who were supported the government. As in Libya now, I'm trying to warn Libyans, don't try to brand everybody who worked for the government that lasted for 40 years as being really counter-revolutionary. Or they have a really odd name. Tahalib means also, you know, seaweeds, they call them. The one who supported Gaddafi. And I said, you can't do that. And there are institutions and there are good people who try to serve the country regardless of the government. And you don't expect people who had to make end living to just become a hero overnight. You can't do that. That's not really reasonable. I think the same thing, Iraq, Libya, we need to rethink the categories, the assumptions, the way we think about them. And I think that will help us understand not only what went wrong, but also how to help these countries make the peace. And the historical example that this country did in the past is Western Europe and Japan. And I think with all the mistakes that were in, there were investment in the peacemaking, not only toppling the regime, but also in peacemaking. As we engage in the coming decade, I think it's never too late to learn the lessons and the mistakes of the past.
It would be nice to end with a softball question.
Yeah.
I don't have one, but what I have is one that might have an optimistic answer. Given that Libya has been a rather progressive Muslim state, can it become a force against the spread of violent extremist groups such as ISIS?
The answer is yes. Libya is now, of course, could descend into becoming, unfortunately, even the gains of the civic institution and values and social capital that allowed my grandparents, my parents, and educated me to, before I went to Egypt and came to America, that really sustains society beyond politics, is there. And I think this is where you go back to that really social and economic capital that allows you to rebuild. And I always say in my talks to Libyans that in 1951, the elite that led Libyan independence fought like crazy. At the end of the day, they agreed Libyan independence is a gain for everybody. A constitution is important for everybody. A democratic process will allow everybody, even though they had three capitals instead of one. But I think the founding fathers of the Libyan state give a good example, no matter what people want to say about them, that compromise for the sake of building the country and society is a positive thing. And unless you compromise, you fight until everybody loses. So I think going back to the Libyan historic experience and the generation that built the state might be a good thing to learn from. It's never too late when you reach a dead end, as we say in the United States, to turn around and find a different route to that. And the situation now is terrible. There's no question about it. But it's not inevitable.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.